Americans came to know Condoleezza Rice as a key player in President George W. Bush's decision to go to war in Afghanistan and then Iraq. The former Secretary of State, in fact, was nicknamed the Warrior Princess for her hawkish views. Now Condoleezza Rice is out with a memoir on her life before she joined the Bush administration. It's a deeply personal account of growing up in the last violent days of segregation in Birmingham, Alabama, a place she writes was then known as Bombingham. The title, Extraordinary Ordinary People, honors in particular her mother, a teacher, and her father, an educator and minister.
People very often ask me, well, how did you become who you are? And I always say you had to know John and Angelina Rice. So this is really their story and my life wrapped in their story.
What many people might know about you is that you are a talented and trained pianist. You played for the Queen of England with Aretha Franklin, but your name was also because of music.
That's right. My mother and my grandmother and great-grandmother, for that matter, were all musicians. And my mother decided that she wanted to have a musical name, a musical term. And she, in fact, thought about several. She thought about Andantino, but that kind of meant walking slowly. That she didn't like the implications of that. She certainly didn't like Allegro because you didn't want your daughter to be thought of as fast.
Certainly not in the 50s.
Certainly not in the 50s. That's right. So she decided instead to look at this term, condolcezza, which meant with sweetness. And she played with the ending so that the English ear would hear it correctly. And that's how we got Condoleezza.
Both of your parents cared a lot about culture and about learning and about accomplishment.
Absolutely. In my family, anything that was considered an educational opportunity, they wanted me to be able to do. I would even say that my parents and their friends in our community thought of education as a kind of armor against racism. If you were well-educated and you spoke well, then there was only so much they could do to you.
They being racist white people.
But there was no doubt that you had to be twice as good to be accepted. And it was said really kind of as a matter of fact. Nobody debated whether that was right, wrong, or indifferent.
As a child, you were also told that there would be no victims.
That's right. That was a sin. To consider yourself victimized or not able to control your destiny or your fate, that was the one cardinal sin in our community.
You described Birmingham of the 1950s into the early 1960s as eclipsing, and I'm quoting you, every other big American city in the ugliness of its racism. Actually a dangerous place for a young black girl and her family. Tell us about one moment that communicates what you mean by that.
Well, Birmingham was a place where when you saw the police, you assumed they were up to something that was going to be dangerous for you. And then, of course, it all exploded in 1963 with the riots and fire hoses and the police dogs, and then ultimately the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in September of 1963, where four little girls just trying to go to Sunday school were killed in the basement of that church. And if you were a child in Birmingham, you knew then that this was not a safe place.
And you knew one of those little girls, Denise McNair.
I did. She was a couple of years older than I, but we knew each other and played together. And Birmingham just wasn't that big, so everybody knew those little girls personally.
You tell a story that's very particular to you. When you were just about 6 or 7 years old, you went to see Santa Claus at Christmas time. Yeah. Tell us that story.
Well, we had a kind of tradition, Mom and Dad and I, of going down to one of the big stores at Christmas time, and they had window displays, and we would go and shop, and I would go and see Santa Claus. And I remember hearing my father, as we were standing in line, say that Santa Claus was treating the little white kids differently than little black kids. He was sitting the little white kids on his knee, and he was holding the little black kids off at a distance. And my father said to my mother, "And if he does that to Condoleezza, I'm going to pull all that stuff off him and just expose him as the cracker that he is." And, you know, you're a little kid, and I sort of went forward with a lot of trepidation. I wasn't really sure who was going to go off here, Santa Claus or Daddy. My dad was a big man. He was 6'2" and built like a football player. But Santa put me on his knee and he said, "Well, little girl, what do you want for Christmas?" And I told him, but I remember thinking at that moment, wow, that was pretty charged, and maybe a little bit later, pretty racially charged, and of all things about Santa Claus.
Now, your father and your mother as well decided not to march in the different marches that were happening in that era and certainly in Birmingham. And you write about that and what their thinking was there.
Yes. My parents and many of their friends didn't march with Martin Luther King. They did their part. One of the things that I wanted to get through in this book is this idea that it was all very black and white, so to speak, that you either supported what the civil rights movement was doing or you didn't if you didn't march. And in fact, these were people, teachers, who, for instance, refused to give over the names of their students to the state authorities so that the students could go ahead and march and not lose the right to graduate. These were people who joined the boycott of the stores. These were people who played their role. But they chose not to march, and my father was very clear about why he wouldn't. My dad was not someone who you would strike with a billy club and he wouldn't strike back. It just wasn't in him. As he said to my mother, I overheard them. He wasn't saying it to me. I overheard them. They would have hit him, meaning the police. He would have fought back, and his daughter would have been an orphan.
You know, do you think that hearing these stories of your childhood, people listening will be surprised, those who know you only as Secretary of State under George W. Bush, under the Bush administration?
I don't know. I think that what is surprising to me is the number of people who've said to me, I had no idea what segregated Alabama was really like. Everybody knows roughly that there were bad times in 63. But the degree of segregation and hatred, and how my parents and our community reacted to it, not being beaten down by it, not even being particularly bitter about it, but rather believing, well, you may not have been able to control those circumstances, but you could control how you reacted to your circumstances. Maybe that's a good story for people to know.
Condoleezza Rice, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was great to be with you.
Condoleezza Rice is now at Stanford University. You can read an excerpt from her memoir at npr.org. This is NPR News.
A senior leader of the Mormons, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, recently stirred up a controversy with his remarks about gays. Gay rights groups say the statements are dangerous, inaccurate, and could lead to more gay teen suicides. From member station KUER in Salt Lake City, Jenny Brundine reports.
Tuesday afternoon, about a dozen gay rights leaders approached one of the tallest buildings in Salt Lake City, the Mormon Church headquarters. They were carrying a box.
Joe, nice to meet you.
Church spokesperson Scott Trotter greeted them and took the cardboard box, containing 150,000 signatures from people across the country. They're upset by these recent statements about gays and lesbians from church leader Boyd K. Packer.
Some suppose that they were preset and cannot overcome what they feel are inborn tendencies toward the impure and the unnatural. Not so. Why would our Heavenly Father do that to anyone?
We want to tell men like Boyd K. Packer that we are tired of watching our children die.
Eric Ethington of Pride in Utah organized an earlier protest against the church. Thousands dressed in black lay silently head to toe circling a six-block perimeter. Among them was 24-year-old Zachary Reichert. He's gay and was raised Mormon. He says his mother supports him, but his father wants him to go to therapy to make him straight.
I was on the verge of thinking of suicide, and it really was. Luckily, I have a great sister, but it was really hard, and I really do understand that why kids think about it, because religion has a huge impact on your life.
The Mormon leader's sermon came on the heels of several gay teen suicides across the country, and Human Rights Campaign Director Joe Solomonese says that's particularly harmful.
The danger with the statements that he made is that they will be believed as revealed truth and then used by some to rationalize discrimination or violence, and by others to perpetuate a self-loathing or suicide. That is simply not acceptable conduct by a man who should know better.
Soleimani says there's a moral imperative to correct Packer's statements. He noted that the American Psychological Association and other groups have found that same-sex attraction is normal and that therapies to make people straight cause harm. Late Tuesday afternoon, church leaders issued a rare statement in response to the protest. In it, they recognized that there are gay Mormons in their congregations. They also said it's not a sin to be attracted to people of the same sex, but it is sinful to act on those feelings. Church spokesperson Michael Otterson reiterated the Mormon doctrinal position.
Any sexual activity outside of marriage is wrong, and we define marriage as between a man and a woman. However, that should never, ever be used as justification for unkindness.
Otterson went on to point out that the church has recently spoken in favor of protections for gays in jobs and housing. Christine Hagland is editor of the Boston-based publication Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought. She says Packer's statements do highlight a theological dilemma for many Mormons.
That really is the heart of it for Mormons, I think, to try and figure out what it means that people should be born with this inclination that can't be mapped onto Mormon theology.
The incident comes at a time when the Mormon Church is trying to repair its image after the fallout for its support of California's ban on gay marriage. Meanwhile, a Facebook page praising Packer's statements has attracted thousands of fans. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Brundine in Salt Lake City.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. It used to be that doctors fresh out of medical school started or joined a practice. More and more doctors are skipping private practice and going to work for hospitals. One in every six doctors in the U.S. is now employed by a hospital, according to the American Medical Association. We're going to be hearing about this trend over the next couple of days. Jenny Gold of our partner Kaiser Health News brings us today a tale of two sisters, both doctors, who've chosen very different paths.
Dr. Lisa Roberts opened her gynecology practice here in Raleigh, North Carolina, about 8 years ago. In black scrubs, a set of pearls, and dark red lipstick, she looks glamorous. And she has an office to match.
We just wanted people actually to come into the office, and we wanted to fool them and make them think they were in a spa rather than in a physician's office. And I joke with them that our intention was to make them think that until they had to get in that position that everybody's dreading and, you know, wanting to put off.
The cloth robes instead of paper, the curtained-off dressing rooms, the vases of dried flowers. She even has a fully stocked beverage bar in the waiting room. She's in charge of everything, from designing the space to billing insurance companies to making sure the air conditioning works. It's a big responsibility, but she's happy to do it.
I like being a small business owner, and I like those functions as much as I love to go to the OR and operate or just to see my patients for their routine visits.
And by running her own business, Robert says she can personally control and guarantee the best medical care for her patients. But not all doctors have her passion for business, including her older sister, Dr. Michelle Roberts Casey. Casey's a primary care doctor who works right around the corner in a large office building on the campus of the hospital where her sister operates. She's one of a growing number of doctors who are giving up private practice altogether.
Hi, Jess.
Hi.
How you doing?
Fine.
Good to see you again.
And same here.
Thanks.
Dr. Casey enters her exam room with a warm smile, clutching her laptop. She looks like a more casual version of her sister, with blonde hair and a white coat. Casey started at Wake Med Health and Hospitals in April after leaving the private practice where she'd worked for 9 years. At first, she thought about opening her own practice with a few colleagues, but
we were looking at property within the city and electronic record systems, and it was a little bit overwhelming to look at the number of different things that you have to tackle to start a practice.
That's when WakeMed approached and offered her a competitive salary plus a bonus. And they promised to handle all of the administrative tasks for the practice. Billing, help negotiating payments from insurers, even adding an electronic health record system. She thought of her sister, and the offer was hard to pass up.
part of what she did actually led me to do what I do, because I saw the day-to-day difficulties that she has faced over the years.
Including the hours of administrative work.
We don't have that here. We can focus on patients, we can take good care of our patients, and they can remain our priority.
Many of her patients moved with her. Janice Seitzinger met Dr. Casey 5 years ago at a free clinic for victims of Hurricane Katrina.
She's been my doctor ever since, so when she moved here, of course, I came with her.
Have you noticed any changes between that practice and this practice?
Not really. I mean, she's the same. She uses her laptop here instead of writing things.
But WakeMed hopes that sooner or later, patients like Seitzinger will notice a difference for the better. Dr. Susan Weaver hired Casey and runs all of the physician practices at WakeMed.
It's about how you can really work together to elevate the level of care while keeping the cost down. Medicine's going to change, and we're going to be prepared to change with it.
The idea is that by teaming up, doctors and hospitals can avoid repeat tests and unnecessary procedures and offer the best possible care at the lowest price. It's a notion that's long been percolating in the healthcare field, but Weaver says the new health law is accelerating things.
What it's really doing is it's making physicians nervous. They're sensing that change is necessary, and they want and desire and need perhaps a partnership with a health system.
But some say the relationships could also have a downside. The more doctors and hospitals team up, the less competition there is in the healthcare marketplace. And like everywhere else, that can drive costs up. That story tomorrow. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Gold.
In this part of the show, we're going to hear about some of the challenges facing young athletes. We begin with tennis, where the formula for developing future pros is to identify talented kids at a young age and then ship them off to residential tennis academies. Tennis great John McEnroe has come up with an alternative. The John McEnroe Tennis Academy is officially open for business in New York City. NPR's Mike Pesca went to the 20-court facility on New York's Randall's Island and sent this report.
Good, and bouncing on the toes, and bouncing, and bouncing, and bouncing, and bouncing.
On one court, a cluster of 10-year-olds haltingly weaves, no, clomps its way through orange cones. Some have clearly cast off the directive to employ a cross-step. Others are trying to adhere to the wishes of instructor Nate MG, but their legs are at war with themselves.
Small, 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 small. And go, okay.
One court over, Hungarian-born instructor Meshi Syros is leading the same drill with her 10-year-olds, trying to perfect what is literally a small step. But in the big picture, what's going on may in fact be a large step in developing the next great American tennis star. This scene and the one playing out on all the other courts is under the aegis of one of the past great American stars, John McEnroe. John's brother and the facility's manager, Mark, a lawyer by trade, recognizes the value of his name.
For the first time, I think, in my professional life, the name has helped me a lot since I've been here.
What makes the activities within this tennis bubble in the East River promising or threatening, depending on your view, is the Academy's aim. John McEnroe believes promising tennis players shouldn't have to leave home and forgo all other sports at an early age. He didn't. But Nick Bollettieri, founder of the Academy that turned out Monica Seles, Maria Sharapova, Jim Courier, and Andre Agassi, points to his record of success.
I think in the world of tennis today, you have to be around an atmosphere that other people are dedicated. I'm going to be a player, and that you have to have survival of the fittest.
Bollettieri, a former Army paratrooper, has a promotional video on his website, which ends with these words.
You know, losing can become a habit as well as winning. And I believe there should be a place for losers and a place for winners. And I want to be with winners.
The problem for U.S. tennis is a lack of winners these days. The highest-ranked American male is Andy Roddick at 10. The Williams sisters are the only American women ranked in the top 60. Mark McEnroe is frustrated that the live-in academies are still the prevailing model.
It's kind of the model that my brother Patrick is now following with the USTA, and we're trying to say that's not the only way, and for some people, you know, the way we're trying to do it will work as well.
And yes, you heard right. There's another McEnroe brother with yet another opinion on the matter. Patrick McEnroe is in charge of player development for the U.S. Tennis Association.
As much as I love my brothers and communicate with them regularly, they're a little misguided in saying that we believe in our program that the only way to go is to bring kids together from the time they're 10 years old. That's not the only way. We don't support that as the only way. But we certainly think that that is a way and the most common way these days.
Is everybody ready to play?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay.
On the opening day of the John McEnroe Academy, the talk wasn't of who would be the next American to win a Grand Slam. Parents like Bonnie Spiegel, mother of James and Nelson, were just eager for the kids to get some exercise and have some fun. Spiegel was a little disappointed that the Academy's namesake, who was supposed to be on hand, was waylaid by rain at the U.S. Open.
I love Johnny. Johnny Mack, he's the coolest.
Others, like 7-year-old Alexandra Goloff, took McEnroe's absence in stride.
Do you know who John McEnroe is?
He announces stuff at the U.S. Open.
Did he ever play tennis? Do you know about that?
No.
Judging from the cars in the parking lot and the prep school T-shirts, most Academy members were well-heeled Manhattanites. But the Academy says an expansive scholarship program is in the works. That will depend on financial success, which will in part be driven by the success of the players. The fame of the John McEnroe name is the carrot. The accomplishment of his charges will be the measuring stick. Mike Pesca, NPR News, New York.